That's saxophonist or saxophonist, if you care to pronounce it that way, saxophonist. But you also have to soften your voice when you say it this way, saxophonist. Jackie McLean and his quintet with Hypnosis. It's the title track from his 1967 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're going to have a little fun today talking about a plan, it seems, that some leaders have. A plan. They seem to have a plan with Trump. What is that plan, you say? Well, the plan is to play ball. That's the plan. Let's play ball. President Donald Trump wants to make nice. It's finally getting through to him that his presidential brand stinks and that he is the main reason that it stinks. You know it's bad when your own party helps to defeat you in your first big league battle. Trump clearly is in a bind. But wherever there's crisis, you know, there is, as the saying goes, opportunity. Thinking tactically, Trump now says he wants to reach out to Democrats and forge a working relationship with them. How nice. How very gentlemanly. But, you know, I got a clue about how this might happen, how this might come about. I read in Counterpunch, on counterpunch.org, an opinion piece by the great Reverend Jesse Jackson about the same thing. He's talking about that nasty word, coalition. Yeah. Yes, he wants to form a coalition. He thinks it's a good idea. You know, Jackson, since the 2016 election, has been cast to the periphery of black politics, although he still retains, in his mind, the status of statesman. But he already has penned this op-ed piece urging that Trump form a, quote, bipartisan coalition, unquote, to advise on the nation's pressing problems. In other words, he wants in. And he sees an opportunity in all of this chaos, because this is all that it has been since Trump took office. In the midst of all the chaos, might there be room for Jesse Jackson to come in and play his coalition card once again? Well, let me share this with you. This is what he wrote. At least this is what he allegedly wrote. He might have had somebody else write it, and he just signed it. But here it is. Pay close attention. You'll pick up a lot of clues. The decision... Oh, sorry, let me start with the title. The title is Trump Should Form a Bipartisan Coalition to Get Real Reforms. The decision of House Republicans to torpedo the American Health Care Act, their own leadership's plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, is a stunning defeat for President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan. It also rescues the 24 million Americans that were projected by the Congressional Budget Office to lose health care under the bill, particularly older, low-wage families and residents in rural areas. The defeat of the AHCA, that's the American Health Care Act, as it's now being referred to, is as much a triumph of small d Democratic resistance as a failure of Trump and Ryan. The real test of leadership is how Trump reacts to the setback. His first reaction was understandably bitter. He said he'd move on to other issues and sit back and let what he calls Obamacare collapse, with insurance companies hiking costs or pulling out of the exchanges altogether. That distorts reality. According to the CBO, that's the Congressional Budget Office, and other experts, the ACA exchanges have stabilized, and cost increases are slower on average than they were before passage of the law. Expanded Medicaid is providing some 10 million with basic coverage. The major problem is the cruelty of the Republican governors who have chosen to deprive their constituents of expanded Medicaid. The Trump Care debacle established that there is no majority, even in a Republican-controlled Congress, for depriving millions of health care coverage. The majority of Americans have joined the rest of the industrialized world in conceiving that health care is a right, not a privilege. Obama's health care reforms provided millions with access to health insurance or to Medicaid, yet more than 20 million Americans still go without. The Kaiser Family Foundation reports these are most families with one low-wage worker who simply cannot afford coverage. Many more are priced out of decent coverage, particularly with the prescription drug market rigged by the drug companies so that Americans pay the highest prices in the world. Reform is still needed. Trump is president of all America, not merely the Republican right. In running for president, he promised repeatedly that he would produce health care reform that would, quote, cover everybody, unquote, with insurance that cost less and offered better coverage. He signed on to a Ryan plan that scorned his promise. It featured tax cuts for the very wealthy, paid for by depriving millions of health care. Now is time for Trump to lead, to build a coalition that can pass a reform that meets his promise. Trump should recalibrate, reach out to Democrats, and forge a new coalition for reform. If he were truly the bold populist leader he claims to be, he would join with Bernie Sanders, whom he has often praised, and develop a path to Medicare for all. He might start with empowering Medicare and the exchanges to negotiate bulk discounts for drugs, add a public option into the exchanges to keep insurance companies honest, lower the eligible age for Medicare to 55, relieving companies of covering older workers who have the highest health care bills. That would provide companies with massive savings and older workers with immense relief. It could be easily paid for by progressive taxes on the wealthiest Americans or a financial speculation tax to limit destabilizing computer-based nanosecond stock trading. Democrats have celebrated Trump's embarrassment, but they too have a stake in reform. They need to do more than simply defend the current system. They need to reach out to Trump and explore if smart reforms are possible with a new bipartisan coalition. Trump could and should break with the right-wing Freedom Caucus Republicans who led the assault against him. They want to repeal the ACA without replacing it. They are out of step with the vast majority of Americans. Instead, Trump could forge a bipartisan coalition to drive real reforms that would move us much closer to fulfilling his campaign promise. Tasting defeat is not the test of leadership. All leaders experience defeat sometime. The question is how they react. True leaders pick themselves up, learn from the experience, and move forward. Trump could turn the lemons that the Republican caucus delivered to him into lemonade, but only if he seeks to fulfill his campaign pledge by reaching out to Democrats and forging a new majority to make health care a right in this country. The tagline for this op-ed piece is, Jesse Jackson is the founder of Rainbow Push, People United to Save Humanity. Well, all right. That was a very nice thing for Jesse Jackson to do, to put his thoughts on paper, although it has the distinctive character of a piece written for him, which he, of course, approved, and therefore it bears his byline. But it appears today in counterpunch.org. And I thought it fascinating because this idea of coalition building, now that Trump has been smacked silly by his own party, by the super right of his own party, and received such a stunning blow to this effort to dump and carve up Barack Obama's Obamacare, he finally is getting the signal that he is a trapped guy. He's trapped. His own FBI and CIA are running their own plan. They're not looking to him for direction or permission to do or not do anything. They are their own little country. Congress, the House, is also not so deep into Trump's pockets, so he's having trouble in Congress with his own party. The Democrats are, this is how they're spinning this whole thing. The Democrats are attempting to make a comeback, but from what? They have no power. They're acting like they do, but they don't. I mean, just last week, the Democratic National Committee basically demanded all staff members to tender their resignations. This is supposed to give the message, to send the message that now they're getting down to work now. They're rebuilding, and they're real serious. So they fire everybody. Everybody is expected to tender their resignations by April the 15th. Now, by the way, this is not including the people who ran the party into the ground. This is just the staff. The staff folks are the ones paying the price for the mistakes and blunders and the corruption and the awful leadership of the officers of the Democratic National Committee. The people who are actually responsible for running the party into the ground, for destroying it. They did not get that memo. Presumably, they have no reason to fear. It is the staff. But anyway, to come back to the point, The Democratic Party is in tatters. It is actually in the process of trying to rebuild. So it fortunately, the ultra-right-wing Republicans really kicked Trump's butt. And so that defeat is presenting to the Democratic Party an opportunity now to take credit. We did it too. Yes, we did. We defended Barack Obama. We defended our guy, and we defended Obamacare. Well, the record is true that no Democrat voted for this revamped Trump care. But it can't be said that the Democrats were pivotal in the shooting down of the proposed health care plan by the Republicans. But now they see an opportunity. They have to scramble and get back on track. But for what? Trump sees them as a useful tool at this moment. They are in bad shape. They need as much resurrection as he does. So maybe he sends out these little signals saying, well, yes, I am the president of all the people. I'm not the jerk you think I am. And moving forward, as they say all the time, it would make sense that we should have a meeting, sit down and put our heads together and see what we could come up with that we have mutual agreement on, and work on those things in the interest of the American people. Sure. And in the vacuum, because, nature just abhors a vacuum, you have the interlopers showing up again. The Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons and others. This is when they show up, offering their services. This is what this piece is all about. It's it advances some interesting ideas about forging coalition efforts and so forth, and to sit down and talk. Let us sit down and reason together. And who would those people be? Jesse shows up, present and accounted for. Yes, I have this great vision. And my great vision is to forge a coalition movement. And, of course, he's not saying, call me. But he is saying, call me. Because he had been relegated to the periphery last year. Throughout the whole presidential election, his only job was to go and beat the Bushes to get some votes for Sister Hillary. He had no real purpose or use within the epicenter of the Democratic Party. He was cast aside. And he literally had to muscle his way back in to get even a smidgen of attention as a so-called political leader. Well, of course, there's very little reason to be sympathetic to Jesse Jackson, who blew it twice in 1984 and 1988. Being a stooge for the Democratic Party, the way Bernie Sanders is today. Although he had a very good shot, as Bernie Sanders did in 2016, at building a coalition, for crying out loud. Here he is talking to, sending a message to Donald Trump. Coalition politics is what is needed right now. This is the best way to go. This is something that we knew. 1984-1988. So he is making a case under the guise of writing a rather statesman-like opinion piece that he has this great vision, this great insight, that a good approach to politics, a good approach to solving the morass that we find ourselves in, and when I say we, I mean the political leadership across the board, all of them, the duopoly and the independent movements, the burgeoning movements, all of them appear to have no logical response to solving where we are, especially with the doomsday administration that has enveloped us and is overriding us. So for all intents and purposes, here's what it boils down to. Now, they could say it's a coalition effort, but I say, once again, you know what that means. Black folks, Latinos, we need you to save us. They all need black folks and Latinos to save us. That's what that chant is all about. This business, this call for a coalition, this recognition, finally, of coalition. It's always about trying to get black folks and Latinos, put them back into service to save this political system that has imploded and continues to implode. And they're now, because probably there was no meeting. They didn't even have to have a meeting. People like Jesse Jackson know automatically what they need to do. They have to take the charge. They have to sound the trumpets, the clarion call. And this is how they do it. Making it sound like a great political idea, when in fact, we know what is coming. What's with this call for, the sudden call for coalition building? And how relevant it could be. And if, you know, Jesse Jackson even is touting the qualifications of Bernie Sanders. Yeah, let's just get in the game, fellas. A door, there's a door here. Let's open it. We could regain some ground. And they're not talking, by the way, about what is the in the interests of the people. They're talking about themselves, how to revive their political career and their political standing. How to use these interests of the people to put themselves back in the political realm. Because right now, Trump isn't talking to them. They're not talking to Trump. You can't get political traction that way. You need to have some basis to afford continuous contact. And since Trump is in trouble, the Democratic Party is in trouble, these people with political ambitions are all in trouble. The Sanders of the world. You have the others like Jesse Jackson, whose time has gone, but still believes he is entitled to having a presence. He is an elder statesman of politics, of black politics at that. the Sharptons of the world, they didn't have any contact, any constant contact going on with this administration. It's not interested in Black and Latinos, Blacks and Latinos. So here we go. Suddenly we see an op-ed piece. It looks very straightforward, like any other op-ed piece. But when you read it carefully, you see this is a plea by the leadership, including the leadership of the Democratic Party, what it's doing, this business of firing everybody, and hopefully by April 15th, they will decide who stays and who goes permanently. But they're not firing. They didn't ask Donna Brazile. She's not one of those people who received demand your resignation letter. She didn't get one of those. The people who steered this party way off course made horrendous mistakes. None of those people are getting resignation letters. How about that? So the more things change, the more they stay the same. We'll take this break and come to your thoughts. The question really on the table is there any logic to this approach, you think? The idea that, you know, we should really try to find a way to sit down and talk with Donald Trump. And we should form a coalition that should sit down and talk with Donald Trump. Is there any validity, you think, to that? Or is this a way, again, as I said, of reestablishing the old order? You know, people who now are reinstalling themselves as the buffers between the community and President Chaos. We'll take this break and come to your calls and comments at 888-874-4888 right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I am Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about signs that there are plans afoot to revitalize a new old order. A new old order. People are trying to figure ways in which to broach the question of how. These are people who are outside. Clearly, they're outside. They know that. How do they broach the issue of establishing some kind of rapport with President Chaos? How do they do that and make it not look suspicious? As if there were ulterior motives, as if this is a logical thing to do. In the world of politics, we know that people have to get along. Even if they vigorously disagree with each other, it is the nature of politics that people try to find some kind of common ground, because in the end, they have to talk to each other somehow. But this piece that I just shared with you from counterpunch.org, with a byline by Jesse Jackson, gives a very interesting indication that people are prepared to play ball. They just don't quite know how to broach the subject in a way that would still make them look legitimate. Patricia from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, you, Teresa. I'm glad you're doing well, and good afternoon to the PRN family.
Thank you.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly, which I never do, but you made a comment that the Democratic Party, the Democrats made a feeble attempt to counter the Donald Trump and his health plan. So Gregory Meeks, who is a congressman from New York here, called into one of our local radio shows on Sunday and was championing the fact that the Democrats had helped defeat this bill. So I actually called in, and my statement to him was that, you know, he was being really disingenuous about this because the Democrats really had absolutely nothing to do with the defeat of this bill. Sure, they voted as a bloc, but the real people who defeated this bill were all those white folks who showed up at those town hall meetings and made certain that their Republican legislators did not support this bill. They were the ones who defeated this bill. So I think that I keep asking these folks when they call in, you know, people like Yvette Clark and Greg Meeks, who are Congress representatives from New York, what is the plan? What's your plan? I literally ask them every time I call, what is your plan? And nobody can ever answer me. I get well.
Like,
you know,
I said the other day, there ain't no plan.
Well, that's the point. They don't have a plan. And so Yvette Clark told me that I was being divisive. Greg Meek said that, well, you know, we're planning for the 2018 midterm elections. And so I said, then what are we supposed to do in the meantime? Our children are in apartheid schools. Well, and then I got a click. Click means they hung up. They hung up on me.
The famous click. Well, you see, you touched on the problem. The big secret is the Democrats don't have a plan.
They don't have a plan.
They have no plan. And by the way, that also goes for Donald Trump.
Well, that is true also.
Trump has no plan. He is winging this, and he's doing this on the strength of the presumed hatred by his group for Barack Obama. And he is mining Barack Obama, I mean, to the nth degree. This is his plan. That will take some time, enough time, he thinks. It will pick up enough time that would give whoever it is he has assigned the task of coming up with some kind of plan for something, that they'll have a plan. But the campaign against what I called Obama's ghost, that could last a good couple of months, you know, while they figure out what they're going to really do. But nobody here has plans.
Well, I just thought I would share that with you. It was truly comical.
Remember, I shared with you the results of a poll in which it appeared to the public that the Democrats also have no leader. So,
yes.
I mean, this is the craziness that we're dealing with. They have no discernible leader. And Charles Schumer now is trying to figure out that, well, maybe it ought to be him. And you see the jockeying going on there. You have Charles Schumer on one end, and you have Nancy Pelosi reaffirming her authority as the leader in the House. So I guess within the Democratic world, they're kind of operating on a pro tem basis in terms of leadership. We have no idea what's going on.
No, and Elizabeth Warren is missing in action. So everybody's winging it.
I tell you, maybe she did, in fact, take the instruction to sit down. Maybe she just did that. Thanks, Patricia, for calling and getting us started today. You see how politics works? Now, they will have you believe that this is a logical, level-headed decision that is being made. The fact is, they're all scrambling. They are all scrambling to figure out how to get back on some kind of an even keel that the people will buy. I mean, Trump is reeling. You know he is reeling and really, really angry when he's actually open to some form of dialogue, something that would show him talking to black people and Latinos, because that is the group that they're all looking to right now to legitimize the fact that things are in such disarray and to legitimize their authority. The Democrats have no authority. They have no clout. And they have no plan. So with all of this going on, they still have to scramble and pretend like they have some kind of sway. They can't abandon the so-called party because, you know, you blink your eyes and there are midterm elections to be held. All right? So how are you going to have midterm? How are you going to sell the people on voting Democrat for the midterm elections when they're just pulverized and they're not being seen as you know, being in the thick of it? So this moment of crisis is affording a whole bunch of people an opportunity to crawl back into what they considered to be their rightful places of authority and influence, knowing that it would be welcomed. You know, they have nothing else going. They have nothing else going. So I thought I would share that. When I saw that op-ed piece, I go, oh my gosh, have they no shame? And the answer is no, they have no shame. But they do these things again, you know, at a certain level. You can't help but be offended because they, again, are playing on the heartstrings of the people to reintroduce a system that was completely ineffective, to the masses of people that did so much damage to them, didn't help them much. Khalil from South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrecht. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Oh, it's a beautiful day here in the sunny south. So this is very interesting because everything's blown up. You know, both parties are in a fiery mess. And I just think it's very interesting how on the GOP side, Bannon has already, he made it quite clear, 2 weeks ago, that he was in the mood and in the manner of deconstructing the government. And people better pay attention to how they're doing this. This is frightening because they've given a bad name to bureaucrats. And I've been a bureaucrat. I've been a paper pusher. And, you know, not in D.C., but I was in D.C. for a little while. But my point is that bureaucrats keep the country running. You know, you need folks who know how the institution works, no matter where you work. You got to know the mission statement. You got to know the rules. And when you start not hiring people, when you start to let people go who have seniority, you destroy institutions. And if you don't have something to put in its place, you get what's called a vacuum, right? You get a vacuum. You know, that's what causes wars around the world, vacuum, power vacuums. So we're dealing with that. But the fact that he admitted that he is in the, that they are deconstructing. I mean, we've been saying that, but that he admitted it.
Well, he didn't say deconstructing. I think the word he used was destroying.
I was being nice then.
Yeah. To destroy the bureaucratic state.
But, okay, you know, that's not good. But if that's what you want to do, then what you must have something in place.
Let me ask you this question. Is there, I know I'm presuming, because you have said it before, but you're not a Trump person. But no. Is there some degree of advantage, you think? Is there a strategic advantage for people like the Democrats or whoever to open some kind of rapport or dialogue with Mr. Trump? Or is it a foregone conclusion that basically it would all be for show?
Okay, that's a very good question. My best guess is that knowing Trump's character now, knowing the mentally ill fascist his mental state, he can't stand to lose. You see, just like as you stated earlier, he's willing. He said, "I'm willing. If the Democrats are going to come to me, they're going to come." Right? He can't stand to lose, so it may be a front, but the fact that he really, his personality will not accept him losing, he's desperate now. But are we ready? Our side's not ready. I don't think that's the thing. We, once again, we're back to what do we have in place? You see, we should have.
Exactly.
You know, and you, I mean, it's fine to break down a system, but you must have a system to put in its place. Just like I'm a believer in co-opting the Democratic Party because, come on, this is nonsense now. This is the time that, and we can do this. And I'm very encouraged between that Women's March that was right after the inauguration and then with these town halls. Look what we did with just protests with these town halls. Okay, because this current administration has not passed any legislation yet. They're trying, but all he's done is sign executive orders. So he's no much better than Brock. But, yeah, so we have to have So to answer your question, it's murky. I don't know because he really has no ideology. He's all about his ego and what is expedient to feed his ego. But his minions, the people around him, they have an agenda. So that's, mm-hmm. that could be where the problem lies. But if you remember a couple of weeks ago, you remember I brought up Paul Manafort? I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. This is a bigger problem. I think that this issue with the administration and Russia and blackmail, and it's just so much. I think this is so big that we may never get the truth because it could absolutely destroy what C. Rutt Knowles called the power elite. It could destroy their sense of power and the illusion that they have
power.
We
will
over.
Have to watch this because one gets a sense that there is some desire to make a move, but nobody knows how to make the move and what are they making the move for and what are they making the move with? Because they're all, in one way or the other, they're in trouble. They're in trouble. And we will get on another day, we will talk about what wonderful opportunity this presents for independent movements and the protest movements that you just talked about, the women's movement and so forth, when we are seeing proof of the impact of people-powered movements in
yeah.
this particular administration. So there, too, they gotta gear up. Thanks a lot, Khalil, for your call. We go to Florida next. Ray, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you, Ray?
Doing well.
Good.
In honor of you're discussing the Trump versus Obama legacy battle, I've reworded your African proverb to say that when two malignant narcissists fight, it's the grass that dies of boredom.
Wait a minute, I didn't mean to drown out.
You stepped on my line.
Could you start again? I'm so sorry, I drowned it.
Take three. When two malignant narcissists fight, it's the grass that dies of boredom. And so somebody used the metaphor of the matador's cape. for what's going on in Washington. You know, we're all looking at this flourish of pink and red satin, and behind it is the sword. But yep. We don't see the sword, and we don't even care about it. And I thought that was, for whoever brought it up, I thought that was a brilliant way to describe it. You know, I still think that the biggest risk is this constant demonizing of Russia. It's not, did Russia interfere, all this, you know, spy, counter-spy garbage. It's the tanks that are moving into Poland and, you know, this rah-rah militarization against a threat that is non-existent. And yet Trump is so weak that he is, and I'm not a supporter of his, as you know, but he's, from his actions and from his inactions, he's allowing the deep state to push him around.
And, but, you know, I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss this business of Russian spying and whatnot, and I'll tell you why. Russia itself has gone through a dramatic change, and have you noticed how many Russian oligarchs there are?
I mean, well, I don't have a head count.
Well, they are significant enough to ease their way throughout the world. They have so much money, and this money came to them in all kinds of ways, but absolutely via corruption, but also through a failed, a parallel system of capitalism, raw, uncontrolled capitalism in Russia by the power elite. The Russian oligarchs are everywhere. In Miami Beach, in South Beach, a large number of these high-rise buildings with their penthouse apartments that are running in the millions, a large part of the clientele in the real estate sector, it's Russians.
Well,
lots and lots of money. They own all kinds of nightclubs and posh restaurants and whatnot. And this is happening all over the place. Russians suddenly have so much money. And they're all tied to the central government. So I think there's something there. There's a lot of smoke there. And I think also some fire behind all that smoke, about what kind of transformation went on after Glasnost and to now. What happened to that economy? How did it grow to the point where you have, I mean, ridiculous amounts of wealth in the hands of a very small circle of people? That is a story.
Buying condos is a far cry from, you know, threatening our borders the way we are threatening theirs. So, you know, I'm not discounting what you say. I used to live in New York, and I know about Brighton Beach and yada yada yada. But I'm not seeing any form of belligerence. You know, I can think of two major things that Putin has actually defused. And that was years ago when we were determined to attack Syria. And he went, no. Why don't you just let us take this poison gas away from Assad and we'll dispose of it? And John Kerry said, that's not good enough. We want to bomb them. And Putin said, no. We'll dispose of the gas, you know, and then Washington had to come up with a different excuse. So there's a subtlety that, you know, that most Americans are not aware of. Regarding that Russia will defend itself, but I don't see any offensive moves. I do not.
Well, right now, there is some great unease within the borders of Russia, where people are concerned about the Putin regime. We do have, I mean, we're seeing people being assassinated on the street. People being poisoned with plutonium and other things. So there's great concern. Putin, however, is very smart, a very smart person, and not to be underestimated at all. But I think the whole world is like that now. This uncontrolled greed and uncontrolled corruption. And it seems that you could hardly put faith in any government, any formal government right now, that it is on the up and up and that there's no corruption. I'm not idealistic enough to say, well, there shouldn't be any corruption. We know it's going to happen. We have to accept that. But this level of greed and corruption and the violence associated with it, and I don't remember a time in recent years, recent decades, that we have seen this level of piracy and wealth. I can't remember a time in recent memory.
No.
Thanks, Ray, for calling. You want to finish up?
No, I don't think we can do it in the time left. So move on.
Okay, so we'll continue. We'll continue the discussion. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Thank you all for contributing. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. And you better listen more and more to the NDC Savings Club in the interest of putting your own system of survival together. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.